Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monaco Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. This week, we're delving into modern French dining, away from the nation's confines. We visit the restaurants drawing inspiration from this most venerated of gastronomic traditions, all the while going well beyond haute cuisine. Coming up, we sit down with the founder of Bistro Freddy and find out why a wave of new French-inspired spots has been sweeping London and many more cities besides.
There seems to be a trend shifting back towards more comfortable seating, maybe, and white tablecloths, and maybe people are eating out slightly less, so when they are going out for dinner, it wants to feel maybe it's a little bit more formal, kind of a bit more of a treat.
Also on the programme, Charlotte McDonald-Gibson tells us about the special role that French restaurants play in Washington, D.C.
I think D.C. has beautiful reflections of French cuisine, you know, and you can see it through this city. It's alive here.
Plus, Gregory Scruggs is in Seattle to meet the man putting his own spin on Gallic classics. All that here on The Menu on Monaco Radio. Certain cuisines have always been well represented all around the world. Most towns can count at least one Italian, Japanese, Chinese, and of course French restaurant on their address book. But for too many years, French cuisine, at least abroad, was associated with a certain stuck-upness, all white, starched tablecloths and formal service. That's not the version of French food that Dominic Hamdi fell in love with and that he's referencing at Bistro Freddy, his new opening in East London. And he's not the only one. All around the city, many restaurateurs beside him have decided it's high time to find a modern way to approach this cuisine by borrowing from its heartier, most unassuming aspects. As its name suggests, Bistro Freddy is a place that pays homage to that most beloved institution of casual, effortless French dining, the bistro. Hamdi's version may feature white tablecloths and handwritten menus, but it's not trying to be a copycat of Parisian haunts. There's a British slant on proceedings that ensures a connection to its surroundings too. Hamdi also runs other successful modern European spots around town, including Crispin and Bar Crispin. So when we sat down in the studio, I was keen to find out what drew him to lean French in this new project and what is it that makes a bistro truly a bistro.
The etymology of the word bistro is actually when Paris was occupied by the Russians, they would go to kind of small eateries and bars and shout bistro, bistro, which means quickly, quickly in Russian. So that is the kind of the folklore behind the etymology of the word, but no one really knows. I think for Bistro Freddy, it's really the idea of a bistro for me conjures up ideas of really convivial place, which is not too pretentious, somewhere you can take your parents for, you know, birthday or anniversary, or somewhere you can go with friends for a slightly more lively dinner. So it's really kind of the aesthetic, the atmosphere of somewhere that is unpretentious, somewhere you can go every week. And that's classic Parisian bistros for me. That's kind of the starting point, really.
Well, I want to dive into Paris and into Frenchness because it's my impression that in the last few months, let's say, here in London, there have been a spate of kind of French-inspired, French-leaning openings. And your other restaurants have a sort of European flair to them, but they're not quite so directly French in identity. Did you deliberately want to make a place that thought about French cuisine in a different way? And why do you think this interest in French cuisine across the board all of a sudden?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a couple of things here. We've seen in London a spate of new openings such as Maison Francois, Bouchon Racine, obviously Bistro Freddy. And there seems to be a trend shifting back towards more comfortable seating, maybe, and white tablecloths and people going out for dinner. Maybe people are eating out slightly less, so when they are going out for dinner, it wants to feel maybe it's a little bit more formal, kind of a bit more of a treat, I suppose. For me personally, Bistro Freddy is the latest iteration of my personal food journey, and I think as I have matured a little bit, so have the restaurants that I'm opening. I think you can see that in Bistro Freddy compared to Crispin and Bar Crispin, which are, you know, they're small plate concepts that have, they're a little bit more stripped back, and Bistro Freddy is a bit more indulgent, a bit more luxurious, and a bit more grown up, I think.
So let's talk about small plates. Do you think that we are moving towards a world where people want to go back a little bit to
start a main dessert, their own plate of food in front of them, no sharing, no forks across a table?
I think it depends, really. So, interestingly, at Bistro Freddy, you're encouraged to eat maybe a couple of snacks for the table, a starter each, a main each, and some sides. But what we're seeing increasingly is actually our demographics still want to eat in a small plate style. They want one of each main and they want to share all of that across the table. We maybe have a slightly older demographic that are coming to Bistro Freddy who want that starter main dessert form of dining. So I don't think small plates are going anywhere necessarily. The dining trends from the guest point of view is one thing, but also at Crispin and Bar Crispin, we really have a small plates concept because the kitchens are so small, and so it really works for that size building. I think for bigger restaurants and brasseries, it's easier to deliver a starter main dessert concept. But typically in London, most restaurants are quite tight on space, so the small plates concept where dishes come out as they're ready works logistically much better. So I think, and rents definitely aren't getting any cheaper. So I think we'll continue to see small plates continuing through the eating trends in London.
Let's go back to France, in the sense that I'm interested in finding out why you are attracted to French cuisine and whether you think that in this way of looking at it, there is a sense that French cuisine needs looking at from an outsider's point of view, needs refreshing in certain respects, perhaps in its iterations abroad. Where is French cuisine moving to when it's not in France? And does it need updating?
Yeah, I mean, French cuisine is the basis for many other cuisines. We can kind of see France as the godfather or the godmother of European cooking. I'd say specifically for Bistro Freddy, it's really a mix of English, British, French food. It's not one or the other. So a few examples is one of the snacks is sausage with brown sauce, which is very typical English condiment, and then alongside that we've got an eggs mayonnaise, which is something you might see on most bistro menus in France. Likewise, on the mains we have a big pie. I think at the moment it's chicken, mushroom and leek, but we've also got a bavette steak with a peppercorn sauce. So for our concept specifically, it's a love letter to France, but it also wants to feel nostalgic and respectful of their cuisine whilst maybe making it our own. You know, we love snails, very French dish, but we're putting them on a grilled flatbread with tarragon butter, something you wouldn't see in France. So we're taking inspiration, really. There was a long period in London where French restaurants certainly weren't on trend. And I think there's an element of people just really wanting to be having a sense of comfort when they go out for dinner. And French food is, at its heart, the most comforting food. And it's exciting for diners in the UK to re-explore what French cuisine is. And maybe post-Brexit, we're missing our French friends slightly.
Aren't we just? But I think it's interesting because there is a certain sense of old-schoolness and vintage flair to some of these French classics, right? You know, you've mentioned the snails. I've seen on some of the kind of your sample menus, the parfait, obviously plenty of tarragon. I'm interested in the fact that you say that you also do canapés, because canapés are so kind of 70s cocktail party, right? How do canapés live in the modern world? Is it kind of a bit of a throwback? And what's a great canapé?
Yeah, I think there's an element of nostalgia that's really, it's just really exciting to people at the moment. And whether that's retro canapés or sticky toffee pudding that we've got on the menu, which is something that you might have at school. So there's definitely an element of nostalgia and throwback that is exciting. And we can see that across culture, really, from what's on Netflix at the moment and through everything. There's definitely a shift back towards slightly more classic, more nostalgic things across culture.
Are you a nostalgic kind of guy when food matters and in general?
I think food evokes so many emotions, and if you can go into a restaurant and you can have dishes that are transportative, that is such an exciting thing. You know, going to the restaurant, curtains close behind you, you're transported away from whatever your week has brought so far, and you're immersed in a world that has so many touch points that has been thought about by designers, restaurateurs, what's coming through the speakers, what's on the plate, the instruments you're eating with, the glassware. There are so many elements within a restaurant, and I think if you can have a fully immersive experience where you're being transported to another time, flavours that will take you back to your childhood, that's such a powerful thing.
Is there a dish on the menu that does that to you? Like, that's connected to a specific memory?
I think snails, particularly. My parents, my grandmother is from Alsace. There's lots of French influence in my house growing up. My mum is German. They used to have dinner parties and cook snails every single dinner party. And, we'd set the table with all the different glassware, the specific, be helping prepare the snails in specific pots. And that was 1990s Yorkshire, so it was quite exotic.
Pushing the boat out, truly.
So I think for that reason, snails just, they evoke another time and there's a sense of childhood and playfulness within that.
Let's go back to how you got into this. From snails in 1990s Yorkshire, how did you get into the hospitality business? What led you to it? And what led you eventually to the many adventures that kind of transformed into Crispin?
Yeah, it's not a linear story, really. And I think, like many restaurateurs or hospitalitarians, I fell into it by mistake, really. I was studying languages in London. I just finished a year abroad in Vienna and Montpellier. And I started a Scotch egg stall with a friend. So we were kind of cooking Scotch eggs in our student flat. We wanted a summer project, so we started a Scotch egg stall on Berwick Street in Soho. And from there, we went to Borough Market, started trading there, started wholesaling these Scotch eggs. And we did that for a couple of years before opening a coffee shop on Aldwych, so just by the Strand, our first bricks and mortar site. And then that was when speciality coffee was really hitting London in a big way. So we were following that trend. And really from there, just it's been a natural progression into Crispin and slightly more immersive dining experiences. And I think post-COVID, Crispin had been open for a couple of years. We started a wine subscription service off the back of that, which was, it was a great success. We were able to open Bar Crispin in Soho, which was a more wine-focused version of what Crispin is. So it's really been about creating concepts that excite us, recognising maybe what people want at what times and following those habits and those patterns. And I think at the moment, Bistro Freddy is the latest iteration of where I am as a restaurateur and what I think people want to eat at the moment.
That was Dominic Hamdi speaking to me at Midori House.
Even if most new French-inspired openings may be moving away from the high-end standard, haute cuisine restaurants have played a huge role in shaping the course of global gastronomy, and in certain contexts, they can have a specific, very practical purpose. As a fundamental centre of global power, Washington DC has long relied on its bounty of formal French dining rooms. In the diplomatic scene, these are places where envoys and officials try to impress their network over elaborate lunches and dinners. But Matt Conroy and his wife Isabel Koss wanted to spotlight another side of French dining in the US capital. Their modern neo-bistro Lutèce is now one of the top restaurants in the city and no less of a place to take someone you want to dazzle. Monocle's Charlotte McDonald-Gibson headed to their outpost to find out more.
When eating at Lutèce, a neo-bistro in Washington's historic Georgetown district, you only need to look up for a reminder of a more traditional French dining experience. A white tin roof is emblazoned with delicate laurel reliefs, and above a doorway are two black and white portraits of Napoleon. These are the few throwbacks to Lutèce's predecessor, a crêperie called Café Bonaparte, which featured all the trappings of a more traditional French dining, with dark red menus and dishes with names like Moulin Rouge. Today, Lutèce is free from such cliché. With its clean decor of electric blue exterior, exposed brick, unadorned marble tabletops and antique mirrors against white walls, its atmosphere is modern but intimate, exactly like the Parisian neo-bistros that head chef Matt Conroy seeks to emulate.
We cooked the food we were inspired to cook and poured the wines that we enjoy. The music's a little different. There's no white tablecloths. I think people have fun. Part of dining that I don't like is the stuffiness of it. I want to eat the same food that I could eat in a stuffy restaurant, but we could all sit down, we order a fun bottle of wine, you're a little loud, it can be a little messy and everyone just having a good time. I think for restaurants, it's like, for me, it's a place to catch up with your friends and have a good time, not sit there and straight and not want to talk and like that. I just don't like that part of it. So I always say this is a restaurant that like I want to eat at or we want to eat at or like the music is what we want. And we stuck really true to that and like it paid off.
The food, seasonal and local ingredients prepared in imaginative ways with a classic French technique, is drawing both crowds and plaudits. Since a soft opening just before the COVID pandemic, Lutèce has been topping the lists of best restaurants in DC. And in 2022, it made it onto the New York Times list of the 50 best restaurants nationwide. While Lutèce is very much taking its cue from the new generation of Parisian neo-bistros like Chateaubriand and Septime, there is a long tradition of French influence in the US capital, where the very layout of the streets is the creation of a Frenchman, Pierre L'Enfant, who mapped out Washington in the late 18th century. It's an influence which infuses the city, says Lutèce's pastry chef, Isabelle Cosse.
It's inevitable to walk around DC, walk around the roundabouts, you know, and be reminded of a European type of life. So I think DC has beautiful reflections of French cuisine, you know, and you can see it through this city. It's alive here.
And as a city of diplomats, lobbyists, politicians and other power players, French cuisine has long played a role in the deal-making and networking that defines the city, says Matt.
French food always has this kind of like, for a long time it was a little, not stuffy, but it was like, you know, you had to sit up straight and you had the white tablecloths and you had that, you know, the server's going to have a tux on or a jacket. And it was, if you wanted to take someone out and kind of show off to them, it was, you know, you're going to order a big bottle of Burgundy and like have that experience. And it's a luxury. It had that feel to it.
Jean-Louis Paladin brought Nouvelle Cuisine to the Watergate complex in 1979, and dozens of traditional French dining establishments have plied Washington's great and good with mounds of foie gras, steak frites, and duck à l'orange over the years. But until husband and wife team Matt and Isabelle put Lutèce on DC's dining map, there was little sign of modern French cuisine in the capital.
Coming to DC, and especially in Georgetown, saying to people that we were opening a bistro, and they came in and they didn't see those traditional dishes on the menu, it was definitely a shock. We did something, I think, different here. And we flat out had people walk in and say, this isn't going to work.
But it worked perfectly. Matt and Isabelle are both trained in the classical French techniques and bring that attention to detail and respect for ingredients, while finding new ways to provoke and delight by creating modern and unexpected takes on traditional French cuisine. Matt talks me through a new dish on the menu, a chicken mousse with morels and a sauce americaine.
So yeah, what's happening here then? What have you got on the go here?
Yeah, so we got our chicken necks that we've stuffed with the chicken mousse. So inside of there is the mousse that has morels and some herbs and stuff like that. So again, very traditional, but having fun with it. And then we have some first of the season asparagus, sauce americaine that we made with lobster shells that we had from a dish before. So just really making sure we're using every part and, you know, very seasonal and stuff. So we're gonna sear off the chicken. So we're gonna sear it off all sides to kind of get the skin crispy in the oven, and then we'll finish with the asparagus and sauce.
Isabelle, meanwhile, has fun with the desserts. Lutèce wanted to put a cheese plate on the menu, but cheese after dinner is not a cultural staple in America, and they only sold about one platter a week. So Isabelle created what is now one of Lutèce's most popular desserts. Honeycomb ice cream, piled high with Comté cheese, its tiny crystals bringing to mind mounds of white chocolate.
Representation, it's a honeycomb semifreddo. It's already pre-frozen. We use egg yolks, egg whites, and heavy cream. We fold honeycomb on it. That is a type of caramel that we add baking soda once the caramel become amber color, so creates a lot of bubbles. It makes a very, very crunchy. You can kind of hear it. It's good for biting. So we fold a lot of those little pieces inside of the semifreddo, freeze it, it all gets the flavor of it. And then on top of that, we add more of that honeycomb just so it has like extra crunch. I feel here in the US, we love crunchy. Crunchy as a part of the ingredient. And on top of that, I have some Comté cheese. This one's 18-month aged. It has a really nice salinity on it and sweetness. So it makes it very light to eat. It kind of dissolves into your mouth. You know, and you can even taste like the salt of the cheese. I think this would make really good justice to the cheesemakers of this particular Comté.
So where did the Comté come from?
Comes from France. Another of those things that, you know, as much as I like local stuff, and there's incredible local cheeses here, at least in Pennsylvania or Maryland, I think French cheese tops some of them.
To accompany the menu of large and small dishes is a wine list of organic and biodynamic wines, most of them sourced from France. The atmosphere in the dining room is lively, intimate, and convivial.
So right here, plum paisan, potatoes cooked in duck fat, creme fraiche, some golden etc. caviar, and then hiramasa. So we do a quick cure on it. We crust it with nori, fennel, and fennel pollen. You have an apricot gel, a little bit of nasturtium, and a dill. Eat these in any order you want. I say use your fingers to have fun. Plum paisan will be hot in the center, so be careful.
So our lamb tartare. This lamb's coming out of Colorado. It's tossed around in a harissa aioli. Top some egg yolk jam, a little sesame crumble that's made from sesame, sunflower, and agave. And so that'll add some crunch to it. And then we have an egg yolk jam, and we have the fresh feta, and then a little bit of dill and mint as well.
Tucked away on the shelves amidst wine bottles and houseplants are unobtrusive nods to the restaurant's provenance. A statue of Michelin Man. A Julia Child's cookbook. You may be close to the heart of power in Washington, but the atmosphere is decidedly laid back and European, which is exactly how Matt and Isabel want it.
It gets loud and people order the whole menu and it feels like that restaurant you want to eat at. It feels like a restaurant. It feels like eating in France, you know? And it's if you meet in Paris, if you eat around in France, it's impossible to not fall in love with that sentiment and wanted to recreate it.
Charlotte McDonald Gibson there. This is The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's George Ruskin.
The deputy mayor of Milan has proposed a controversial regulation on late-night takeaway food that will hit the city's beloved gelaterias. The plan aims to reduce noise in Milan's nightlife spots by forcing food outlets to close earlier. This has caused backlash. Locals argue that the proposal will fail to solve the problem of noise and will instead end the popular tradition of late-night ice cream. With the general election underway in India, businesses in Bengaluru have begun offering free food and drink to encourage people to cast their vote. The city has historically seen some of the lowest voter turnout in the country. However, there are hopes that first-time voters will be enticed to polling stations by the prospect of free beer, dosas, and milkshakes at venues across the city. In New York, people are reselling dinner reservations for the city's top restaurants for up to $1,000 for a two-top table. Mobile app Appointment Trader is at the forefront of this new trend, and for some New Yorkers, selling reservations has become a full-time job. Genuine diners, however, have become increasingly frustrated by automated bots that are driving up prices on the platform. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, George. You're listening to The Menu. Now we head across the US, all the way to the West Coast, to drop into another restaurant with a fresh take on all things Gallic. L'Oursin in Seattle is the brainchild of American Zach Overman and French chef JJ Preville. The pair met in the New York culinary scene before moving cross-country to make a new start with the abundant seafood and produce of the Pacific Northwest. With a name that means urchin, the restaurant is fronted by a cheeky mascot, a beret-wearing, cigarette-smoking garçon with a look of studied indifference. It's an obviously self-conscious play on the stereotype, and it points to a light-hearted approach to French food that knows not to take itself too seriously. Monocle's Seattle correspondent Gregory Scruggs took a seat at L'Oursin, and he brings us this report.
Bonjour, how's it going? You must be Zach.
Hey, Greg. Nice to meet you. Welcome in. Please join me. My name is Zach Overman. I am the co-owner of L'Oursin Restaurant and Bar Bayonne here in Seattle. I like to think of them as sort of northern and southern France. L'Oursin is our restaurant that's been open for almost 8 years now. We've had Bar Bayonne open for about 6 months and is a much more casual wine bar, sort of more southern France and northern Spain. Bar Bayonne kind of does a little bit of everything. We've got our market here, which has tons of organic and biodynamic wine. We have sandwiches to go. We have a ton of cheese. It's a specialty French products. We're selling records, because why not? So it functions sort of as an all-day cafe, as well as more of a wine bar at night. This is sort of our imagined French nostalgia bar, definitely tapping back into our love of music and movies from the 90s when we were coming of age, sadly a very long time ago now. So yeah, just trying to keep Bar Bayonne much more casual, much more fun, very low stakes and just like a fun room to hang out, discover things. There's something everywhere you look in here, which I love. Lots of little hidden Easter eggs and goodies all over the place.
I mean, I see everything from Depeche Mode to Serge Gainsbourg being hyped on the walls here, this kind of blending of cultural influences.
Our whole MO is not trying to be authentically French at all, but sort of taking those influences that we love from France and definitely filtering them through our lens and our experience.
Where did this love affair begin, and what inspired you to bring an interpretation of French food and drink to this side of the continent?
I'd been a Francophile for a long time. My first trip to France was actually my honeymoon. My wife and I went to the first city we stepped foot in was Saint-Malo, so we were walking around this ancient walled city and drove around the coast of Brittany, which actually is like shockingly like the Pacific Northwest. Feel a real analog between that place and here, and the cold water and the rain and the fog, and it just feels, I felt very at home there. Yeah, we just drove around and ate amazing shellfish. There were these women in Cancale just shucking oysters on the beach with these giant, knuckly, gnarled hands, like fastest guns in the West. You know, I've never seen somebody shuck an oyster that quickly and that well. They were born to do it. And if there's ever been a moment of experiencing terroir or miroir, I guess, like that was it. You eat the oyster looking at the oyster beds. That was a turning point for sure.
These restaurants are what you once described in an advertisement as French-ish. I mean, we're not talking La Tour d'Argent in Paris, where if anyone were to tweak the recipe for the canard à la presse, there would be riots in the streets. So how do you interpret the vast world of French gastronomy for both this audience and this set of ingredients you have access to here in the Northwest?
For so many Americans, French dining just conjures white tablecloths and stuffy waiters and pretentious wine service, and that's just not what we're about. You know, food should be enjoyable. You should go to a restaurant and have a good time. I think the music should be loud. There should be wine spilled on the table. People should be eating off each other's plates. And so we're taking French technique and French products, but we're not bringing that sort of imagined fine dining vibe. Like, the best meals I've had in France are in wine bars, not fancy restaurants.
So what then ultimately ends up on the menu of a restaurant that is not trying to emulate French fine dining but still capture the best of French gastronomy in a more casual setting?
So I think what we do really well here is filter the amazing bounty of products we have in the Pacific Northwest through this sort of French lens. But we're not beholden to very strict ideas about what French food is. JJ and Holly, our executive chef and chef de cuisine, are really great at sort of interpreting French technique and taking classic dishes and twisting them and adapting them for American palates, refining them a little bit, trashing them up a little bit if necessary. Fried sweetbreads are basically like delicious little chicken nuggets at L'Orson right now with espalette barbecue sauce. So we can take something fancy and make it fun. We can take a very rustic traditional dish from the Jura, stewed chicken with morel mushrooms and Vangeon cream, and really refine that over here with Pacific Northwest morels, wine from the Jura, and just a beautifully roasted chicken. So where you would have a stew, you've got a beautiful half chicken on a plate. So it's just a synthesis of all those things. It's beautiful Pacific Northwest sourcing and French technique and adapting some classic French dishes.
There's endless bottles of wine. You could fill a cave à vin up to the ceiling just with the volume, you know, the size of this space. You have to make selections. How do you do it, and what's on the menu?
Yeah. So all of our wine is natural wine, which I think a lot of people are using that term as like a flaw now. And part of our mission here is to show people that that's not the case. Natural wine is just the production method. It's not a profile. So our entire list goes from incredibly clean, classic, beautiful wines that you would never know were unsulfured or grown organically that you would find on any very traditional wine list in Paris, alongside really funky, fuzzy, weird stuff. And it's the whole gamut. And I think that's what's beautiful about this category of wine is we've got something for everybody right now. We really do. It's just about finding the right bottle.
The bar menu does not... It may begin with wine, but it definitely doesn't end with wine.
No, we have so much brandy. Specifically at Lorsan, we have the biggest brandy collection in Washington by far. It's our favorite. You know, it's an agricultural product that's distilled. So Armagnac from the southwest, Cognac, Calvados from Normandy up in the north. It is around. It's in the food. It's in the cocktails. It's served on its own after dinner. Yeah, we really love it.
Thanks, Gregory. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show, Food Neighborhoods, for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan and Finn Simons. Thanks for listening, and until next week.